Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
The Cannes Film Festival is back. After it was canceled last year, the world's greatest filmmakers finally got to say bonjour to the storied French Riviera town to celebrate a long-awaited return to the festival. French speakers, please don't at me. And the New York Times' Kyle Buchanan was there for it all. The premieres, the parties, and even the mishaps. Kyle reports on pop culture for the Times and writes the paper's award season column, The Projectionist. He joins us now to break down the 74th Cannes Film Festival, which took place from July 6th to July 17th. Kyle, welcome back to All of It.
Thanks for having me, Rebecca.
So, let's start at the beginning, opening night. You begin your coverage of the ceremony by describing the look on actress and Cannes juror Maggie Gyllenhaal's face as she sat in movie theater for the first time in 15 months. What was it like for you to be back, you know, in a crowded theater after this past year?
It was overwhelming. And I think if the Cannes Film Festival can overwhelm you, then it's doing its job. That's kind of the point. It is the most maximal of all of the film festivals. You know, Sundance, Toronto, Telluride, these film festivals all have their charms. But they don't bring that full-scale glamour cinema offensive that Cannes does. And it's pretty incredible that even with some diminishment because of the pandemic, some protocols that kept things a little bit more conservative than they might be. This still felt like such a full-blown Cannes that I am now a walking shell of myself after 2 weeks in the French Riviera, but happily so.
Well, thanks for coming on, even though you must be so exhausted. was it also different to see all these iconic filmmakers making their returns? Did something feel different, better, just worse? I don't know. How did it feel?
I just think there was an excitement about it, an excitement for people to be able to see one another again, and an excitement to go big. You know, probably the biggest premiere that has been held in Hollywood since prior to the pandemic was the premiere of The French Dispatch at Cannes. That's the new film by Wes Anderson, who did The Royal Tenenbaums, Moonrise Kingdom, Grand Budapest Hotel. And for that premiere, he brought, you know, a huge chunk of his really starry cast, Timothy Chalamet, Bill Murray, Tilda Swinton, Benicio del Toro, they were all there. And that was very exciting. You could tell that the Cannes audience was not just giving their standing ovation to that movie, they were giving their standing ovation to the director, to the stars, and to kind of the very concept of big screen glamour, because it was back out in force.
So let's listen to some tape, because the ceremony also featured a screening of this year's opening night film, Annette, starring Adam Driver and Marion Cotillard. Director Leo Carrat also took home this year's Best Director Award. Here's a taste of the trailer.
First time I fell in love, woke up next to the girl and escaped fast and far. But Anne has changed me. What I see in her is obvious. What she sees in me is... it's a little more puzzling.
One, two, three, four!
Kyle, tell us a bit about this film.
Well, you know what, Rebecca? I'll start with the little factoid that baby you hear crying at the end of that Annette snippet is played by a marionette. That gives you a sense of how sort of out there this movie is. I'm not surprised on one level that the jury gave it their Best Director Award, because it really is like, you know, the sort of movie that almost nobody could or would make. It's this really outlandish, out there musical that, even though it has two very big stars in Adam Driver and Marion Cotillard, is obviously, you know, with this marionette baby and a host of other really wild ideas, trying to push the envelope. Amazon is going to debut it on their service next month and in theaters, I believe. So everybody else will get to experience that same sort of feeling of being baffled, but in some cases loving it, that the Cannes audience has.
So you said also in theaters. Is this, you know, a film that you would recommend watching in the theater if people can or want to?
Yes, I think so. I mean, we have watched so many movies over the last year and a half on our television screens.
Mm-hmm.
And when it comes to accessibility, it's great. You know, the ability to be able to watch just about anything at home means that a lot of these movies are more seen than they would ever be. Mm-hmm. At the same time, Rebecca, I think if anything can really reinforce to me how incredible the experience of being a movie theater's willing hostage can be. And I'll give you an example. There's a documentary that I saw there called Cow. It's by the director Andrea Arnold. And it is pretty much exactly what you are expecting based on what I just told you. It is a documentary about a cow. That camera just follows a cow around. The cow moves, the cow gets milk, the cow gives birth, rinse, lather, repeat. And, you know, I'm sure some of your listeners are thinking, well, I mean, what's the point of that? That sounds so uninteresting. But being there in that theater, watching that happen on the big screen, being utterly lost in this cow's just specific experience on a dairy farm, having no, you know, push notifications from my phone bothering me or sunlight streaming in from my living room window, it really just, it was such a gift. I don't think I could have ever gotten so lost in this really specific and ultimately moving documentary if I was watching it at 10 a.m. on Netflix, you know? I mean, these services all have their charms, but that's one thing about the big screen that I just don't think can be beat.
I love it. If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with New York Times pop culture reporter Kyle Buchanan. I'm Rebecca Ibarra, filling in for Allison Stewart, and you're listening to All of It. And then just going back to Annette for a second, how did the audience react to this film specifically?
Well, I think the audience was excited to be back in the theater. It was the opening night movie, so people were incredibly excited about that. You know, the movie is polarizing. In fact, many things at Cannes are polarizing. It's kind of the sort of fun roulette wheel nature of the thing, because you're dealing with auteurs who will make really big gambles in the pursuit of their art. So it's very rare that you have, you know, a guaranteed crowd pleaser that everybody is enamored with. I mean, even the film that won the Palme d'Or, which is the highest award Cannes gives, this year it was a film called Titane by the director Julia de Cournau. And let me just tell you the inciting incident of the movie in a way that I think the censors won't get upset at me for saying, which is that it's about a female serial killer who's impregnated by a car. So we're not dealing with a Marvel movie here, Rebecca. We are dealing with really out there visions, and not everybody is going to be into them. But if you want adventure in your movies, you can't find a place that offers more of that than Cannes.
And we're going to get to that movie in a bit. But first, I want to talk about Jodie Foster, because actress Jodie Foster accepted an honorary Palme d'Or award that night. And why did the jury choose to recognize her?
Well, I think a lot of things. One is she has a, you know, an obviously really wonderful career that has taken place both in front of the camera and behind it. Two is she could come and impress the hell out of everybody by speaking French the entire ceremony. She even did a little master class, I think, the next day, and spoke French pretty much the entire time. So, you know, the French obviously loved that. They were thrilled that the Hollywood star was willing to meet them on their level. But then also, I mean, you know, it's another facet of that opening night and Cannes just as a general thing that on that night they had not just the very starry jury that was led by Spike Lee, not just Jodie Foster, who was getting an honorary Palme d'Or, but all sorts of incredible people from the entire global film industry. They had Bong Joon-ho, the director of Parasite. They had Pedro Almodovar. And in fact, it was Almodovar, Bong Joon-ho, Jodie Foster, and Spike Lee who officially opened the festival. And when you can get you know, four pretty artistic titans to be able to do that, and they're dressed to the nines, and they're in front of an audience full of really excited, glamorous people in tuxedos and couture, it just feels like about the polar opposite of wearing sweatpants in your living room the way we've all had to over the past year.
Absolutely. So you mentioned Titane, and I want to talk about that. And again, I think I should take some French lessons from Jodie Foster.
so should I. Listen.
So as you said, the director and screenwriter, Julia Ducournau, I think I'm pronouncing her name kind of incorrectly. She took
kind of it, yeah.
Okay. The festival's highest prize, you know, the Palme d'Or. But that announcement came a bit earlier than expected. So at the start of the closing ceremony, you know, acclaimed filmmaker and Cannes jury president Spike Lee accidentally announced Titane's win when he was supposed to be announcing the first prize of the night. And we have a clip of that moment that you shared on Twitter. Let's listen to it.
Can you tell me which prize is the first prize?
Yes, I can.
Mais oui.
Cool.
The film that won the Palme d'Or is Titane.
Wait,
le non. Film qui a reçu la Palme d'Or. Non.
Ah, on a évité le pire. Non. Okay, Taharim va lui expliquer comment ça se passe. Moi-même, j'ai mis un peu de temps à comprendre.
Wait, no. What was it like experiencing that?
I mean, utter chaos. But in a way that I personally love out of my award shows. To give your listeners some context, imagine that you tuned into the Oscars and they accidentally read the Best Picture winner first. You know, I think there was a little bit of a language barrier in that Spike Lee interpreted the first prize of the night to mean the first prize winner. They probably should have done some sort of rehearsal so he would know that there were, you know, several prizes to give out in, you know, what's a fairly long ceremony first. But hey, from the perspective of kind of loving mess, it over-delivered. And also primed us for something very exciting, which is Julia Ducournau winning this award. She's the first female director to win the Palme d'Or since Jane Campion won for The Piano, and they are now the only two female directors who've ever won that. And in fact, Campion had to share her prize the year she won because there was a tie. So technically, Julia Ducournau is the first director to win the Palme d'Or outright. For that to happen to a young female director who's just made her second film, and especially for it to happen at Cannes, which for all of its, you know, wonderful virtues, also has the distinct vice of continually underestimating female directors, I would say. The competition is, you don't see the same sort of parity between genders there that you do at other film festivals. So female directors have always had a bit of an uphill climb at Cannes, and I think after Julia Ducournau, that climb is going to be significantly leveled.
And from either your opinion or talking to other people, what do you think makes this film so deserving of that prize?
Well, it's just not like anything, you know. Anybody who saw it was not just trying to figure out a family-safe way of describing the movie, but struggling to figure out what you could even compare it to. I mean, I heard people compare it to David Cronenberg because there's elements of body horror, and certainly there are things that happen in this movie where, you know, only the most hardy among us are not going to flinch or hide their eyes. And to have it coming from this young female French director, and to have it be interested in some of the things that she's clearly interested in, because she's playing with gender, she's playing with your expectations of a lead female character, it's just bracing. You have no idea where this movie is going to go until literally the last frame, which packs its own surprise. So if you're looking for something that's just going to sort of blow your mind, you can hardly have, you know, a film that's more willing to do that than Titane.
I'm Rebecca Ibarra, filling in for Allison Stewart, and I'm speaking with New York Times pop culture reporter Kyle Buchanan. We'll continue our conversation after we take a quick break. Stay with us. I'm Rebecca Ibarra, filling in for Allison Stewart, and we're speaking with New York Times pop culture reporter Kyle Buchanan about the Cannes Film Festival. So, we've mentioned Titan, we've mentioned Cow, but you know, you wrote about a wide range of films in the festival this year, with which subjects ranging from, you know, Cows to Celine Dion. So what other films stood out to you the most? Maybe two or three of your picks.
Yeah, you mentioned Celine Dion, and I must note that some of the fun of Cannes is it's not just, you know, the most sort of highly acclaimed world cinema. There's also a lot of camp. So you have Aline, which was an unofficial Celine Dion biopic, completely off the rails, in part because the 57-year-old director of that film, Valerie Le Mercier, plays Celine at every age of her life, including 5 years old. Wow. I still feel like I maybe had a fever dream and hallucinated it. There's also Benedetta. It is a satirical dramedy from Paul Verhoeven, who directed Basic Instinct and Showgirls. And it's about lesbian nuns in the 17th century. Let your mind go wherever it's going based on that synopsis, and you'll be halfway there. But, you know, there's also really wonderful movies that are kind of down the middle pitches and just work. You know, there's The Worst Person in the World. It's this really great Norwegian romantic drama that I adored. Probably the one with the most Oscar potential is an Iranian film called A Hero by Asghar Farhadi, who did A Separation. He's won two international film Oscars. I would think he's now the front runner for the third one.
And are, you know, any of the Cannes films premiering stateside, you know, anytime soon that we should be on the lookout for?
Yes, actually, you know, there's one in particular that's about to debut, I think just in about 2 weeks. It's named Stillwater, and it stars Matt Damon. It's directed by Tom McCarthy, who did Spotlight. And if you liked Mayor of Easttown, you're going to be into this. In fact, to the point where, you know, we used to get these sorts of character-driven dramas where there's maybe a murder or two fairly regularly in movies. And now we've got another one starring Matt Damon as, you know, this sort of American roughneck father who has to travel to France to try to clear his daughter of a murder that she insists she didn't commit. It's a really sort of fascinating, twisty story, but at the same time, it's really patient, character driven, really interested in this culture clash between, you know, this American who doesn't know probably a lick of French and could never be bothered to learn it, and the French people that he has to try to figure out some sort of way to communicate with so he can get clues to try to clear his daughter. And what's sort of funny and makes it very up to the moment is he starts to develop this sort of spiky romance with a French woman played by Camille Cotton, who's in the French television show called My Agent. And I don't think I heard the theater laugh more than a moment where he's having lunch with her and a friend, and the friend flat out asks, "Did you vote for Trump?" There are those sorts of acknowledgments, especially in the American movies that we saw this year, where there's a little bit of the madness of the past 4 years sort of at the edges of these American movies. They're beginning to grapple with what that cultural moment meant.
You know what? A few weeks ago, I was definitely Googling what shows or movies are like Mayor of Easttown because I needed to watch something similar, so I can't be alone. Let's talk a little bit about, you know, the protocols, because obviously, you know, this festival marked the grand return to cinema, but naturally, it couldn't be a completely normal year. And in your first piece on the festival, you refer to its COVID protocols as, quote, wildly inconsistent. So what was that all about?
Yeah, I mean, the French gave us the phrase laissez-faire for a reason. they, you know, COVID was ever present in everybody's minds. In fact, I heard that the officials from the Cannes Film Festival were working sort of hand in hand with French officials to try to keep the festival open at the same time as France was starting to crack down a little bit when it came to COVID protocols. So what that meant is that you were supposed to wear a mask at all times in the movie theater, but, you know, a lot of people simply weren't, and that was not a heavily enforced rule. What that also meant, weirdly, is that if you were coming from the United States, even if you were vaccinated, you were expected to be tested every 48 hours, whereas anyone who was vaccinated from within the EU could just sort of, you know, blithely walk in and out of any building or theater. And these were also rules that were sort of sprung on the press contingent at the very last minute as we arrived, which I think is an indication of just how much Cannes was figuring this out as it went along. Honestly, every film festival is. We're about to enter the fall film festival season where, you know, film festivals that are usually really enormous, like Venice, like Toronto, like Telluride, are still trying to figure out how they're going to pull this off. Telluride is requiring that every single attendee be vaccinated. The Toronto Film Festival might not actually have press and talent coming from other countries. It might be in person, only a Canadian affair. So these, you know, these festivals that are meant to be gigantic gatherings and generate all sorts of headlines, all sorts of amazing photos from their premieres, are kind of figuring out how going into, you know, year two of managing the situation, are they going to be all virtual or are they going to try to attempt something in person that gives it that extra pop of pop cultural frisson that puts that festival, you know, in the minds, in the eyeballs of people who weren't even there in the way that Cannes just managed.
Was there any point in the festival where, you know, you're someone who clearly loves film and you're there and you're describing this kind of surreal, wonderful moment, but at any point did you think, this is too soon, we're still in a pandemic, maybe we should have put this off another year?
Well, I think everybody had a lot of concerns, especially with the Delta variant, you know. We don't really know how vaccinated everybody else is there. I know I'm vaccinated. I know that I was being tested every 48 hours, and I felt a certain amount of security in that. But I think everybody was just sort of holding their breath, sometimes literally, hoping that this would work, you know. I definitely talked to a lot of colleagues who were much more concerned about it. And in fact, you know, a lot of the people that I might have expected to be there, like the Los Angeles Times critic Justin Chang, or even my colleague Manola Dargis, who's a film critic at the New York Times, did not make the trip. And I know that a lot of people didn't make the trip because they are still, you know, completely justifiably concerned about, can you hold an event like this while the pandemic is still going on. I mean, I made it out alive in more ways than one. I, you know, am still able to talk. I'm not completely comatose after 2 weeks of burning the candle at both ends. But at the same time, you know, I didn't get sick and I took those protocols very seriously. I got tested all the time. I wore my mask and I tried to surround myself literally in the theater with people that I knew would take it as seriously as I was, because certainly looking around at a lot of those French journalists, or even, you know, a lot of the movie stars or people associated with the movies who had, you know, faces full of makeup and didn't necessarily want to put on those masks, there was, like you said at the beginning of this question, a very inconsistent implementation of safety protocols.
And, you know, talking about burning the candle at both ends, you know, the only thing more iconic than Cannes films is the parties. Were you able to attend those gatherings? Tell us what gatherings you did attend and what were they like this year?
I mean, listen, let me tell you just by way of comparison what they're normally like, which is outrageous, outrageous. I feel like I've snuck into the world of the one percenters. And it's just the most wild anthropological mission I've been on. Because in the past, sometimes I've been to parties that you could only get to via helicopter. You know, that's how ridiculously over the top it is. This year was different. There was definitely a muted feel to these parties. In fact, like I said, they still seem to be figuring it out as it went along. So a lot of the really big parties that you would be expecting to go to, there was a little bit of, well, is this really going to happen at all? So I went to parties like, you know, something like the A24 party. That's a very hot production company that usually throws a party at Cannes. And typically there'd be this gigantic line of people trying to get in. This year it was more intimate. You know, there was no line. It wasn't full to bursting. There was the actress Jodie Turner-Smith, who's in A24's film After Yang. She grabbed the aux cords, put on some Cardi B and Megan Thee Stallion, tried to get the party dancing, but there just wasn't enough people. It just wasn't that vibe. You know, the Cannes dance floors, which are always really fun, basically did not exist this year. But the parties that did happen were more intimate, and that's gratifying in a way. But I do think that, again, people go to Cannes to be overwhelmed. People go to Cannes to experience just these wild dinners, parties, after parties, events that you couldn't have anywhere else. And even though there were a lot of really nice things, it wasn't that this year.
You're making me think of the story I heard, and I had to Google it to fact check myself. But Salma Hayek brought, I remember, a mariachi, like a whole Mexican mariachi band to the Cannes Film Festival, I think in like 2017 or something. She flew the whole band just to like brighten up a party. So your story made me think of that. So I guess one last question is, you know, looking back on the festival, if you could pick one or two things that surprised you the most, what would they be?
Well, I think the fact that it felt even a scintilla like the actual Cannes surprised me. I expected something that could maybe get us 50% of the way there. And it was really exciting and encouraging to, you know, despite a little bit of a feeling of intimacy, which is not usually a word I'd use in conjunction with this most maximal film festival, despite that, it did feel crazy. It did feel big. It did feel overwhelming. And it makes me wonder, and I'm sure it made everybody else wonder there, where the film industry is headed over the next several months. You know, obviously, with even just recent developments with the virus, there have been increasing COVID protocols that could kind of threaten the film industry as it begins to claw back, as it begins to reassert itself. But to go to Cannes, you'd almost never know that, you know. Well, if you were a member of the European press who could just swan into these theaters and not get tested, you wouldn't know that. Americans, again, had these like little reminders of, well, all is not completely right. But yeah, to just even have that experience at all, that was a huge surprise. And then honestly, I don't know. I think, you know, to be able to see American movies like Stillwater and like Red Rocket, which is this new movie from the director Sean Baker, the director of The Florida Project. It takes place in 2016, right as Trump is being elected. And it's about this washed up former porn star who returns to his southern hometown and tries to scheme his way back to the top. You know, there are these movies that are dealing with the Trump phenomenon with the last 4 years in ways that aren't completely head on, but that are definitely sort of grappling with what we learned about ourselves, what we're still untangling about ourselves in ways that are intriguing. So I think, you know, it gave me a sense that what we're going to be seeing from a lot of American films, or at least the ones that aren't Marvel movies, is, you know, a sense of dealing with the upheaval of the last 4 years, not just the coronavirus, but also Trump's presidency in ways that can surprise. And certainly, you know, over the next several years, you're going to see that creep its way into a lot of movies.
I've been speaking with New York Times pop culture reporter and friend of the show, Kyle Buchanan. Kyle, thank you so much for joining us on All of It.
Anytime.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.